From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cass. We're on the record. Baltimore's new health commissioner, Dr. Letitia DeRaza, has been on the job for 2 months. She oversees an annual budget of $150 million and initiatives aimed at improving the health of residents young and old.
So much of what the residents of the city need is beyond what I as a pediatrician could do in a 15 or 20 minute visit. It really goes down to some of those basic social needs around housing, access to food, the ability to pay our bills. And I think that the health department really encompasses an agency that seeks to address the whole needs of a person.
Plus, Dr. Giraz's priorities, from food access to halting the opioid overdose epidemic. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Dr. Letitia DeRaza has been on the job as Baltimore's health commissioner for just 60 days. As commissioner of the oldest continuously operating health department in the United States, she oversees an annual budget of $150 million and initiatives that range from mosquito control to home inspections for lead paint hazards to clean needle exchanges. DeRaza is a pediatrician. She earned her bachelor's degree from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and her doctorate of medicine from the Meharry Medical College in Nashville. She completed her residency training at Johns Hopkins and served in multiple leadership roles at Baltimore Medical System, which serves 45,000 uninsured or underinsured patients across the city. Her most recent work before this job was as health innovation officer at a local software firm led by her husband. Dr. DeRaza, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Sheila, for having me.
Why take on this job?
Wow, so many reasons. So a bit of my background you shared. I'm a pediatrician by training. I trained in East Baltimore at Hopkins. I went on to work in private practice for a few years in Anne Arundel County and really felt a pull to come back to the city. And that's when I took on the role at Baltimore Medical System as medical director of school-based health and was eventually promoted to medical director of quality. I would say it was definitely during my time there and even my time in residency where I saw such a great need for access and for really having basic social needs met. So much of what the residents of the city need is beyond what I as a pediatrician could do in a 15 or 20 minute visit. It really goes down to some of those basic social needs around housing, access to food, the ability to pay our bills, access to jobs and training. And I think that the health department really encompasses an agency that seeks to address the whole needs of a person. I think we serve as a convener working with other city agencies, working with quasi-governmental agencies and healthcare institutions to make sure that the residents of Baltimore City, that all of their needs are met for the advancement of their entire health and well-being. So when this job opened up, it was kind of a no-brainer for me. It really encompasses so much of what I think is important to serving the residents of Baltimore City. And then my tech background really came into play because I see the health department as having the ability to really be on the cutting edge with getting data and using that data to drive how we do programming for the residents of Baltimore City.
Yeah, I want to ask you more about that, but let me ask this. How much does your success depend on other leaders in the city, like police commissioner, housing commissioner?
I think it's all interdependent, honestly. You know, no city agency can tackle the issues facing our residents in our city solo. Right. So even as the health department, we are not solely responsible for the health of the residents. I think we have to work in conjunction with BPD and with housing to ensure that all of the needs of the residents are met. So I think we all have to work together and collaborate. And I so far in this role, I've seen that happen pretty well.
Back to your tech background, one of your projects at the software firm was focused on analyzing data from the Baltimore City Health Department.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I would say back in 2016, we were actually part of a grant initiative called Tech Health that awarded local software firms with a small amount of funding to support the build out of a tool that could help the health department to address public health issues. So our company specifically was selected for the build out of a death data dashboard. So this dashboard that we created, and the team created it in just under 7 weeks, was really focused on how do we automate data that the health department receives around deaths occurring across the city. And there are a couple of sources from that data, the state OCME office being one of them. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. So this, receiving that data, and then how do we automate that data so that inside the health department, they can see in real time how deaths are occurring. And it includes all causes of death from heart disease to an opioid overdose. And then how do we utilize that data to create this visual dashboard that the health department can use, again, to understand what the trends are across the city in real time.
I get the urgency of real time if there's some spike in violence or something. Why is that so important, that picture in real time?
Yeah, ideally, if you have that picture in real time, it can guide how you direct your resources. It can let you know in real time how effective your programming really is. One of the challenges of data in general is that it does tend to lag. Any data coming out of OCME, it may not be accurate and fully up to date for a few weeks to months. They have to confirm the suspected cause of death. So I say real time, but there still would be a bit of a lag. But at least internally, you might get that initial picture of what the causes of death are across the city.
So what role do you see technology playing in your tenure as commissioner?
I see it playing a huge role. Because I have a desire for us to have the most up-to-date data, I'll push for that and advocate for our department to really being on the cutting edge when it comes to how we use healthcare technology in a safe way.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Baltimore Health Commissioner Dr. Letitia Durazza, who was sworn in last month. We're talking about her background and her priorities as commissioner. On March 11th, you succeeded Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. What have you been focused on in the 60 days?
So it's definitely been a pretty busy 60 days. When I came in, a big part of what I wanted to do was make sure that I had a full understanding and grasp of all of the programs that the health department supports. So a big part of what I've been doing is familiarizing myself with all of the programs. Another piece of that is looking internally at our operations and looking for ways that we can improve efficiency. So going back to technology, I see that potentially as a way that we can improve our internal efficiency as a department. I've also spent time in a lot of meetings. So meeting with partners around the city, meeting with the quasi-governmental agencies that we support and that support us, really working to build and strengthen those current partnerships and develop new ones.
Yeah, talk to me about what community groups you've been able to connect with and what role those partnerships have in the mission of the health department.
Yeah, so I've sat on a number of community panels since I started. One in West Baltimore. I did one in, I guess that's Highland Town, maybe East Baltimore. I've also met with some of the community-based organizations that we partner with. So Behavioral Health Systems Baltimore, Healthcare Access Maryland is another quasi-governmental agency that I've met with. Baltimore Healthy Start is another agency that I've had the opportunity to sit down and meet with as well.
At your swearing in, you identified reducing inequities in healthcare as your top priority. How?
I think this goes back to what we talked about earlier. It's that interagency and interagency kind of working together to make sure that we're addressing all of the general needs of our patients as a whole. I have a few clinical priorities, but again, I think it still goes back to how we work with other departments. So my clinical priorities are focused on how do we provide trauma-informed care training to students at Baltimore City Schools. So I have met with representatives at BCPS just to begin to have conversations. So again, they would have to be a strong partner with us. We'd have to collaborate to really discuss, you know, how do we potentially expand trauma-informed care training to the school staff so that they feel equipped to work with students who may be experiencing chronic or acute trauma at home or in their neighborhoods. Another area of focus for me is around continuing to address the substance use disorder crisis that we're currently in. We have a very strong partnership with Behavioral Health Systems Baltimore, who, again, has been, I think, helping to lead the charge on making sure that residents of the city have access to recovery. So it's meeting with BHSB, meeting with other community partners who are doing that type of work. So there's certainly harm reduction partnerships that we have. So we will continue along the three-pronged strategy that was previously laid out by Dr. Nguyen. Ensuring that there is sufficient naloxone training across the city. We still do free trainings at the health department. Ensuring that there is significant access to recovery. So I am a strong proponent of the hub and spokes model, which seeks to have an initial hub that provides treatment, specifically medication-assisted treatment through the buprenorphine, and then there are spokes within the community, potentially primary care providers or other service providers who can continue prescribing buprenorphine to patients once they're stable. So again, expanding that access to recovery to the community. And then the last piece of that being reduction in stigma. So we'll continue to work towards ensuring that there's appropriate education for the community so that they understand that substance use disorder is a chronic disease, just like diabetes, and that we should be addressing really the whole person, just like we would with any other chronic disease. My last clinical focus is really around healthy food priority areas. And again, we have a strong partnership with planning, who actually leads the charge on legislation advocacy for ensuring that there are healthy food priority areas. So they work to collect data on what's available in terms of food access throughout the city. And the health department tends to support more on the programmatic side. So we have a program, Baltimore Market, in which we do pretty much virtual grocery shopping. So food delivery for those who may not otherwise have access. So I will again, work hand in hand with Baltimore Food Policy Director to make sure that we're improving access across the city.
We need to take a short pause in our conversation with Baltimore Health Commissioner Dr. Letitia Jaraza. Here on the record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. When we're back, we'll zoom in on more of her priorities and talk about curbing overdose deaths. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning with Dr. Letitia Jaraza, Baltimore's new health commissioner. She's a pediatrician and the first African-American woman to be appointed to head the city health department. She oversees an annual budget of $150 million and 800 employees in a city with significant health disparities between its low and high-income neighborhoods. So you've identified trauma-informed care as a priority. What is trauma-informed care?
So trauma-informed care is a model of care that focuses on making sure that you are addressing someone who may have potentially be exposed to trauma with an empathetic approach to make sure that whoever is providing care to that person understands that they may have been exposed to trauma, and as such, they should be approached in a way that's very sensitive. For example, I think in schools, oftentimes you may see a child that has chronic behavioral problems where the natural inclination may be to discipline that child, place them in detention. When you approach them through the lens of trauma-informed care, you understand that their disciplinary issues may be as a result of chronic trauma that they've been exposed to at home. And as such, as opposed to redisciplining them and potentially inflicting more trauma, you stop and you're empathetic and you have a conversation. You listen. There's some motivational interviewing that's involved as well to ensure that you have a full understanding of why you might see these behavioral issues, and you provide kind of sensitive care for that particular student.
What are the consequences of ignoring trauma-informed care?
So I would say that's maybe part of where we are right now. So I think, you know, there may be a lack of recognition that some of the behavioral issues that we see are related to exposure to repeated trauma. So in the 90s, Kaiser Permanente actually performed a study called the Adverse Childhood Events study, where they looked at
ACEs, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They looked at children that were chronically and acutely exposed to trauma, and they saw that children that had certain levels of indicators were at greater risk later in life when they kind of looked retrospectively for things like heart disease, dementia, stroke, cancer, you know, a slew of chronic diseases. And so if we continue to ignore that there is repeated chronic and acute trauma that our children are exposed to, I think we are potentially kind of setting them on this path where they're at greater risk for chronic illnesses.
Conversely, what are the ripple effects you hope for from paying attention to trauma-informed care?
I hope that in general, we'll become more empathetic to what our children are experiencing, that we'll recognize that, yes, our children are resilient, but that exposure to trauma is never normal. And we should be really trying to address the greater causes of exposure, in addition to making sure that children that are exposed get the treatment that they need.
You have also identified maternal and infant health as a priority. Nationally, Black mothers are 2 to 3 times more likely than white mothers to die from pregnancy and childbirth-related causes. What is the picture in Baltimore?
So we don't know the exact picture because currently they don't break down to the level of the city, the kind of racial disparities. We have it at the level of the state, but we don't know it at the level of the city. However, there was a bill that we supported that will provide us with a higher level of detail around the distinctions between race.
So is it then premature to ask how you intend to approach this issue?
No, I would say Be More for Healthy Babies is a program that has long looked at maternal and child health, specifically infant mortality. They will also be a part of how we look at maternal mortality. So they have a review that meets monthly, a child fatality review that meets monthly to review causes of death in infants and children around the city. And we will continue to carry on once the funding and legislation comes through that type of programming to look at maternal mortality.
I know infant mortality trended down in Baltimore between 2009 and 2016, down more than a third, 36%. Is it still on a downward path?
You know, it is still on a downward path. We did see a slew of infant deaths between December and January of 2018. And what was odd about what we saw was that there was about a death a week, so 6 deaths, still much lower overall than what it had been in 2009 before our Safe to Sleep campaign started.
These were sleeping-related deaths.
These were sleeping-related deaths. So what we did when we noticed that trend is we relaunched and reinvigorated the campaign around Safe to Sleep. So we partner with HCAM, I mentioned earlier, Healthcare Access Maryland, as well as the Family League, to distribute information, to retrain and re-educate pediatricians around the tactics and techniques they should be sharing with their patients. We will also have a conference this summer, free conference, for people to attend, again, to learn even more about safe sleep. So we've continued to launch just greater campaigns and awareness around the issue.
That's Dr. Letitia Jaraza here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her priorities and plans as Baltimore's new health commissioner. I want to get back to the opioid overdose epidemic because it's hit Baltimore really hard. Preliminary data from the State Health Department show that from January to September of last year, about 37% of all opioid overdose deaths in Maryland, both prescription and illicit opioids, took place in the city. Do you have the resources you need to address that?
I think we do if we work with partners. So, you know, as I mentioned, Behavioral Health Systems Baltimore really does support and serve as the local behavioral health authority, and they provide mental health as well as substance use treatment. And they convene with local partners to make sure that there's access. I think, again, our role is to continue to push forward the strategy that we've talked about, the 3-pronged strategy, and I will continue to advocate and push for expansion of the hub and spokes model. So the hub and spokes model where we have kind of that centralized prescriber of buprenorphine to provide that medication-assisted treatment, and again, providers locally being trained to provide buprenorphine to patients and continue treatment.
You mentioned naloxone. Your predecessor, Dr. Wen, focused a lot on getting it into a lot of hands, and there were funding problems being able to pay for it to mm-hmm. get it into enough hands. Are there still funding problems?
So I think one of the challenges we face is certainly the pricing of naloxone. So where we do have funding, we would urge it and encourage it to go generic so that we can purchase even more for distribution. We still have the blanket prescription across the city for those who are interested in getting naloxone. We still offer free trainings and we still have naloxone available, but it is costly. So we'd certainly, you know, would love if it were less expensive.
So do you have an approach in addition to what's already been done to try to solve that?
The cost or the other things?
Just to make sure it's available when people need it.
Yeah, I would continue what Dr. Wen did. I mean, we still have reasonable availability. And I think for us, it's making sure that we're monitoring what's available and what our inventory is. And again, I think I, you know, would take it a step further and really focus on how do we provide recovery and access to treatment.
Fentanyl is a big part of the opioid overdose picture, and it is so much stronger than regular heroin that it eats up a lot of naloxone when someone mm-hmm. tries to reverse a fentanyl overdose. How big a part of the problem is that?
I think it's huge. So certainly the spike that we saw a few years ago and why this epidemic is what it is because of fentanyl. So that is huge. One other thing that I did want to highlight that we're doing is we do have a crisis stabilization center that's been in place since April of 2018, and we're working with local hospitals for those patients who are found by EMS and who receive naloxone and get a reversal of a potential overdose. They can, if they are medically stable as deemed by criteria, be diverted to a crisis stabilization center as opposed to going to an emergency room. So that is something that we're partnering again. BHSB is supporting this effort, but we're partnering with local healthcare institutions to ensure that those patients who are stable enough can go to a crisis stabilization center, have a warm bed, have access to a nurse practitioner and support, as well as get access to kind of these wraparound support services and a case manager that would follow them even once they've been discharged from the crisis stabilization center.
I want to get back to preventing and treating obesity. You talked about trying to address food deserts. Baltimore's been talking about food deserts for more than a decade.
Yeah.
What do you intend to do that will move the needle?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, a big part of what I want to do is maybe a bit more advocacy. Again, I mentioned traditionally planning has done a lot of the advocacy work, and I think they've done an excellent job. I think as health commissioner, I can make it a priority and bring even more attention to it and support their efforts. But again, look for other ways to advance what's already been done.
Before I let you go, I want to ask about measles. Maryland has seen 4 cases of measles this year as the country experiences the greatest number of infections in 25 years. Does Baltimore need to step up enforcement of vaccinations?
So actually, Baltimore does a pretty good job. We've hosted 2 measles vaccine clinics since the initial cases were announced. We have been supported by Maryland Department of Health. We've also been supported by local hospital Sinai, as well as Baltimore County Health Department. So we, I think, are actually doing pretty well at encouraging vaccination rates among those who may not be fully vaccinated. Our first vaccine clinic, we actually immunized over 700 adults who may not have been fully immunized. So we've had a really good amount of support, I think, from the community to make sure that our rates stay pretty high.
How will you judge yourself in a year or so about whether you're being successful?
You know, I, again, mentioned in the beginning, looking at some of our internal and operational efficiencies, I think if I can see advancement and more tech infused into how we're doing work, automating of processes, I can see, you know, programs being able to expand as a result of addressing some of our operational challenges. That looks like success to me.
Thank you so much for telling us what you're up to. Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck. Thank you.
Dr. Leticia DeRaza is a pediatrician. She's been on the job as Baltimore's health commissioner for 2 months. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. Tara Zarfasan is our intern. I'm Sheila Cast. Very glad that you're with us on the Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.